with the four establishments of mindfulness, we were starting to go through them in more detail. Yeah. And of course, there's always even more detail. But this book gives the basic idea to get you going. If you want more detail, then there's books specifically about the four establishments. But then you have to figure out what all the Pali words mean. I received teachings on this from Geshe Sonam Rinchen, and then also I asked His Holiness about it, and he went through, he taught it as well when we were doing one of the meetings and Q&A sessions. So it was very nice. Okay, so we remember the Buddha Dharma Sangha in front of us and all sentient beings around us. And when we die, this is what we want to be thinking about. Our refuge and bodhicitta. So whenever you're in doubt about what to focus on in any situation, refuge, bodhicitta, emptiness. So we have a body and a mind. We live with them all day, all night, our entire lifetime. But we actually don't know very much about them, although we think we do. Because knowing about our body doesn't just mean knowing what kind of food we like and what kind of exercise we like. So here we're trying to really understand our body, our feelings, our mind, and all the other mental factors and other things in a much more realistic way, without all of our opinions, our likes, our dislikes, what are other people say about our body, what other people say about our mind. We're just trying to look at them as they are, which is harder than you think, because we very quickly start branching out into what I like and what I don't like, what I want and what I don't want. So we're trying to keep our mindfulness on those four objects one by one and on different aspects of those objects, such as their impermanence and so on. And see what they are and how they operate together, how they influence each other. And understand how we can designate body. What do we designate body on and independence on? Do we designate mind independence on? So it gets to be very interesting when we start digging into these things. So the reason we're digging is so we can clear away our ignorance, anger, and attachment. Take them as objects and thus be able to free our mind. And by knowing our own body and mind well, and knowing the Buddhist teachings on them well, then to be able to pass this on to other people so that they can also practice and free their minds. So therefore, our aim is full awakening with all the qualities that are needed, wanted, and desired for being of the greatest benefit to all beings. And while we're here this evening, okay, so we were on 3:38. I'm going to start a little bit before that because just to remind us that we're thinking about the causes of the body, the sperm and the egg and all the food we've eaten, the nature of our body, yeah, which is that it's kind of foul. And it's a factory of that makes lots of unpleasant things. And it is also the basis of our precious human life, something that we need to care for so that we can progress on the path to awakening. So we have to learn to balance, have a balanced view of what the body is, you know? And when we come to meditating on the body, we carry a lot of baggage with us, yeah? If we just sit, just think of all of the ideas we have about our body, you know, okay, it's a poop and pee factory. Yeah, okay, we start there. It's also the basis of precious human life. And then it's everything from high school. Yeah, were you obsessed with your body in high school? Yeah, because our body was changing. Yeah, and it felt weird, and it looked weird, and we wanted our body to look weird, like everybody else's body looked weird. But everybody else looked really cool, right? Right? Everybody else, they look cool. Oh, each of us. I mean, did you feel that your body was good enough in high school? You know? That you were with the in crowd of kids who, you know, were always the popular ones because they were good looking. You? No? About you? You don't really what?
I didn't have the pockets where I was too busy making robots.
I still couldn't hear you, but it doesn't matter. But, you know, and then our body doesn't feel well. How do we relate to our body when it doesn't feel well, when it doesn't look the way we want it to look, when it doesn't do what we want it to do? You know, you're in PE class and, you know, do they pick you the first one when, you know, they're going back and forth picking teams? Yeah, not me. Anybody else? I think high school is kind of the same for everybody. Yeah, in Germany, like that. Yeah. In Holland. Yeah. In Canada. Yeah. So, you know, here we are. It's like, yeah. And especially those teenage years And then, of course, going into young adult, which is teenage years magnified. Because that's when you start doing the dating apps, which fortunately came after I was already ordained and not still in high school and not no longer a young adult. But that's where, you know, you're really trying to set your body up as something. Because everybody's, you know, flicking through, you know, they're flicking through. Looking, that one's good, that one's bad, that one's okay. You know, like going through a shopping catalog. Yeah, but that's me, you know. Are you going to buy me? I'm not literally buy, you know. But that's kind of what the mentality is. Huh? And how does that affect us? And then you go to parties, and how does that affect your behavior? How does it affect how you relate to people? Yeah. Sometimes we get very flirty, and we just get used to being flirty, and you ordain, and you're still flirty. Flirty and flighty. Yeah. Is flirty a word? It is. That's good. I know flirt is, but I didn't know flirty. So, you know, and then you age, and then you see people who are 85 who are running the New York Marathon or Boston Marathon, whatever it is, and you go, well, how can they can do that, but I can barely stand up. And, you know, and then you look in the New York Times, and these people, you can't believe, because they put in the love section, who's getting married, you know. The groom is 97, and the bride is, you know, 85. Yeah. Really? Really, it's very interesting. Then you start looking, how do they look when they're that old? You know, is she wearing the same wedding dress that she did when she got married at age 21? You know, how many marriages have these people been through? Have they been happy in any of them? My dad went with my mom to her 50th, you know, when you graduate high school, they have a 50th anniversary.
Reunion?
Huh? Reunion. Yeah, reunion. On, you know, of your class. Yeah, when you get to figure out who's still alive. Yeah, because, I mean, so many things could cause people to die between graduating at 18 and then meeting again at 68. Yeah. And my dad said, because they had all the pictures of, you know, her high school class there and then the people around. And he said he couldn't match any of the old people with the high school people, you know, because they look so different. Yeah. Yeah. So that means that's how people are going to look at us too. Yeah. So, yeah, just to see all the preconceptions we have about our body, you know, what the religion we grew up in told us about our body. You know, it's sinful, it's evil, it's the source of desire. You know, in Judaism, it was, it's a phrase in the Bible, what is it? Something and multiply. God commanded you to, what?
Fruitful.
Yeah, be fruitful and multiply. Yeah? So you, how do you multiply? Through your body. Yeah, you don't duplicate your mind, you know. You have to become a bodhisattva to do that. But, you know, you're supposed to have all sorts of little yous, which are your legacy to the world. That's what you leave behind, is all your children. That's the what you give to the world. Yeah. Isn't it? You know, isn't that what our parents think? Yeah. And then, you know, we may have been indoctrinated with that too. You have to have kids. Otherwise, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? Yeah. So, gotta go out and have kids. Okay, you have them, then what do you do with them? Then you have to bring them up. Okay. But they're the legacy that you leave to the world. This is one of the reasons our parents get are so attached to us. Yeah. It's not because we're always cute and adorable like we were when we were infants, you know? It's okay. So we see the causes of the body, the nature of the body, and the result of the body. Yeah. How does this body end up? As a corpse. Yeah. The poop factory shuts down. Yeah. Okay. So, it's very important when we're doing the mindfulness of the body to be able to hold many different viewpoints of the body. And this goes for the feelings and the mind and so on. You know, so yes, we meditate on the foulness of the body, but that's not the only perspective. Yes, we meditate on the body as the corpse, but that's not the only thing. Yeah. And so you get familiar with what's in your body and how the various organs of your body feel at different times during the day, how your stomach feels when you're hungry, how it feels when you're full. Yeah. Can you feel the rest of the food as it starts going into your intestines? Or do you lose track of it? Oh, lunch got lost in the middle of my big intestine, you know, our small intestines. That's where it stays more of the time. Okay. But sometimes you can feel it moving. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then it's the basis of our precious human life, which was very difficult to come by because it's extremely difficult to create all of the causes for precious human life because a precious human life is not any old or any young human life. You have to have all 18 qualities, and not so many people have those. So, you know, one of the first meditations in the Lam Rim is, you know, the preciousness of the precious human life and the body, and take good care of your body. I was always puzzled, you know, when I would go to see my teachers, one of the first questions they would ask is, how is your health? You know, and so often in my life, I never thought about my health. As long as everything worked okay, I just didn't think about it, you know. And why are they asking me about my health? Well, because the body gets sick and it malfunctions sometimes. Yeah. And so how do we take care of it? And everybody has their own way of taking care of their body. And this can be something that is a topic of a lot of discussion in the monastery. Because some people, you know, they don't feel well. I noticed this in Singapore. I'm not saying that the Singaporean nuns, but in Singapore, you cough and you're going to the doctor. Yeah. You know, it's like people just very sensitive. Some little feeling, you know, go to the doctor. And other people are like, okay, I had that little feeling. I'll wait and see if it goes away. It goes away, fine. Okay. But then it doesn't go away. Well, actually, I don't want to go to the doctor because I don't really want to know what this is. You know, because after all the discussion about cancer and kidney disease and diabetes and all these awful things, I don't want to really know what's wrong with my body. And you get sicker and sicker. And your, you know, little cough of becomes, you know. And, you know, your little coughing up of a little bit of mucus becomes, that's what you're doing all day. And it's like, I don't want to go to the doctor. It'll go away by itself. Yeah. And then it gets really bad and it gets really hard to breathe, or you can't sleep very well because as soon as you lie down, you start coughing again and all this junk starts coming out. And it used to be clear, and then it was like a light yellow, then it became a dark yellow, then it becomes green. Yeah, like kind of the color of your shirt. Yeah, you know? And it's like, that's not normal, but I'll see if it gets better. And then sometimes it has some red in it. What is that? Well, it'll go away. I'm still not going to the doctor. Yeah. But the people you live with in the monastery, it's like something's wrong with you. You got to go to the doctor. No, it's all okay. I'll get well soon. Okay. So there's the people who on the smallest thing run to the doctor, and then the people who, you know, it's really when they're really, really sick that they finally get it. Yeah. If they had gone to the doctor earlier, they could have been saved a lot of suffering. Yeah. But who really wants to know what you actually have when something's wrong? And do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah. But, oh, you know, and then somebody in the community says, you got to go to the doctor. Stop bossing me around. No, really, you know, you have to go to the doctor. We'll talk about it later. You ever had that discussion with anybody who's really sick? Sometimes it happens with your parents. You know, your parents are really sick and something's going on and they don't want to go to the doctor. Or it's, you know, their eyesight is fading and they shouldn't have the car keys. Yeah, good luck in telling them that. That one was really hard, you know, because they couldn't see well, they couldn't drive well. Yeah, you don't want them to get in an accident or to kill somebody else. Yeah, but they don't want to listen to you because you're their kid. And this role reversal that comes about when the body ages, Yeah, and instead of the parent taking care of the kid, now the kid has to take care of the parent. And parents don't always like that. Some parents love it. Oh, now I can relax. Bring me my tea. Bring me my breakfast. You know, they like that. But some parents change their diaper. Mm-mm. Yeah, remind them of when to take their medicine. Mm-mm. Yeah. But we're not going to be like that. We're going to be, I'm just talking about other people, right? Yeah. We're all very cooperative. Yeah. And we know when we're just sick enough and have to go to the doctor. And if we don't do it and somebody in the community says something, oh, we're ever so cooperative. And we make an appointment right away. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you? Do you remember what happened a few years ago?
2013.
I remember very well what happened. Yeah. Yeah, some of you weren't here for it. Shall I tell them? You're here. Were you with me? Yeah, the two of us.
I wish I wasn't here.
What?
I kind of wish I wasn't here.
Yes.
Hard. Yes. It was hard.
Yes. It's one of the things, you know, you think you want to be a senior in the community? Okay. So they walk in. You had gone to what?
India.
Yeah. So in India, you know, most people get sick with something or another. So we're downstairs in Ananda, and these two, we're going to see how embarrassed you get. And that's when you will see the eye, to the object to be negated. Okay, so this is a, you know. So the two of them come in, you know, the back door, the downstairs door, and we're standing there. And we had heard that they were sick. And they come in, and they're like, the sounds that were amazing, you know, like, I don't know that Hollywood couldn't dream up those kind of sounds. They were so sick, you know. And so we say, you need to go to the doctor. Nothing's wrong, they say. You need to go to the doctor. Casket company. Almost. Because they sounded really bad. And eventually you went to the doctor, didn't you?
I went at least two times.
Yeah, we'd already been once, but we went again.
Yeah. And you got medicine, right? Yeah. So remember this story to tell other people. This is our legacy to pass on to all the... No, someday you're going to have, when see somebody who's almost on their deathbed saying, I don't need to go to the doctor, I'm fine, then you will tell the story. But you'll say it happened to somebody else. Yeah, because you want to protect your reputation. Yeah. So do you have the object to be negated?
Not anymore? No, I've worked with this one so much. Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll see if I can fix that.
Oh, yeah, but not on this one.
Okay. So just to stop reading. Start reading. Balance is crucial. On the one hand, we value this body and use it to engage in virtuous actions, Dharma practice, and activities that benefit ourselves and others. On the other hand, attachment to the body leads us to self-indulgence as well as anger when the body becomes ill, anger when it's in pain, and anger when it's dying. Yeah, because we don't like pain. Yeah, we don't like not being able to do what we want to do when we're sick or injured. And we don't like death. So when, you know, there's attachment to the body, then, you know, this comes up. Yeah, so on one hand, the body, precious, we have to take care of it. On the other hand, it's the source of a lot of suffering. Yeah. Okay, so a balanced perspective relates to the body in a healthy way. We know our present body is true dukkha, yet we must protect it because it is the basis of our precious human life. So that's how you want to make sure you conclude things. Yeah, you don't conclude it of my body is foul and it's stinking and I can't stand it. You know, you don't want to come to that. Yeah, but just yes, it's foul, but you don't have to hate it. Okay, so these perspectives that I just went through are not contradictory. From the perspective of being impermanent, made of foul substances, and under the influence of afflictions and karma, you know, with the perspective that it's the basis for pain, from that perspective, the body is not something to cherish. Okay. But from the perspective of it being the physical basis for a precious human life in which all conducive circumstances to practice the Dharma progress on the path and attain liberation and awakening, from that perspective, the body is to be cherished and cared for. So we have to be able to hold both perspectives. And at different times, if we're getting attached to the body, the perspective that it's foul. If we're getting mad at the body, then the perspective that it's the basis on which to practice the Dharma and we cherish. Okay. Okay, so these two perspectives are cultivated at different stages of the path, and they serve different purposes. To arouse enthusiasm for Dharma practice, we rejoice at having a human body, don't we? Yeah, when you do that meditation, you're supposed to come out of it like a beggar who just saw they had a jewel in a pile of poop or something, you know? And it's just like, wow, I'm so fortunate, this jewel of a body to practice the Dharma that I work so hard to get. You know, practicing virtue, abandoning non-virtue in many lives. This wasn't just 5 minutes in another life to create all the causes for a precious human life. Yeah. So to arouse enthusiasm for Dharma practice, we rejoice at having a human body. To strengthen our aspiration for liberation and awakening, we see the undesirability of this body and thus abandon the attachment that the attachment to it that keeps us bound in samsara. Okay? Because, you know, as we're dying, the, you know, one of the main attachments that comes up, you know, are the three that we meditate on, you know, to let go of, you know, possessions, friends and relatives, and our body. Yeah, because those are the things at the time of death you don't want to separate from. Your possessions, you know, for some people, their possessions was the meaning of their life. That's what gave their life validity, that they were worthwhile, that they, you know, were able to earn enough money to support a family, that they were able to give their children an inheritance. They're quite attached to that. Yeah. Yeah. Friends and relatives were attached to them too, because we're always with them. At death, we're separating. Yeah. And sometimes you read of couples that will take some kind of poison together so they can die together. But when you die alone. It doesn't matter how many people are dying together with you, because everybody is having their own experience. And everybody's karma is, individual karma is ripening at that time, you know. And then there's, you know, oh, I have to separate from this body. Without this body, who am I? Yeah, I have a name. If I don't have a body, how can I even have a name? What would my name refer to without a body that doesn't go along with it? And then grasping for the body. Yeah. Anybody. Yeah. Because at the time of death, you get desperate. I'll take anything. Yeah. And depending on what karma, because you're grasping, yeah, at something, then it'll make karma to be reborn in one of the realms ripen. And there you go. Yeah, so, but, you know, to think of who am I going to be without a body? Yeah, that feels weird, doesn't it? Yeah. And then what are other people going to do with my body? Because my body was what people knew me by. And that's how I got a lot of praise, at least when I was young. You know, yeah, or if you're one of these couples that gets married and he's 97 and you're 85, you know, well, yeah, he still tells you you look beautiful, and in your eyes, he really looks handsome, you know, but you're grasping, who am I going to be without a body? Yeah, and so to realize that this body is not worth clinging to. Yeah, it's not worth clinging to. Okay. Then we hear about the bodhisattva practices of bodhisattvas who give their body. And then we get really scared. I love the bodhisattva path. It's so wonderful. I want to be a bodhisattva, but I don't want to give my body. This happens when we're alive, you know. And then we hear some of the stories about them giving their body or parts of the body. They're so weird stories. Yeah. Shariputra apparently had bodhicitta at one point. And somebody came up and asked for his right hand. And so he cut off his right hand and he gave it to the other person with his left hand. But in Indian culture, your left hand is what you use to clean yourself after you poop. And so you don't eat with your left hand. Yeah, if you're with an Indian family, you do not pick up food with your left hand. Okay? So, but he handed somebody wanted his hand, and he gave his right hand with his left hand. And the other guy said, what are you doing? And threw his hand on the ground and walked off. And Shariputra's left there with no hand, and he gave up his bodhicitta at that point. You know, it's the motto of the story is good. But when, I don't know about you, when I look at the details, if a stranger came up to me and asked for my right hand, I wouldn't just take out a cleaver and cut it off. I would first ask, why do you want it? What are you going to use it for? Yeah. And if they say, well, I was just in a war and one of those, what is it, in IBDs, the things in the bombs, you know, the little bombs that they leave by the side of the road.
The landmines.
Like landmines, but there's a special name, IED. Anyway, you know, if somebody says, my hand got blown off by one of those devices. Yeah. And my physical therapist says to get a hand. Yeah. Then I would say, let's see if they can attach it. I would look through, is this really possible? Is it really going to benefit somebody? Yeah. Before I cut off my hand and gave it to them, And I would probably want to go to a hospital and have them do it. So, because if they are going to attach it, they have to match up, label all of the different arteries and stuff in there and muscles so they could attach it to this guy's limb. Yeah. So the moral of this story is don't worry about the details of the stories. Some of the stories, like the one about Aryadeva. Yeah. Somebody came up to him and wanted his eye. So he pulled out his eye and gave it to the guy who then, threw it on the ground and stomped on it. Yeah, but Aryadeva didn't leave his bodhicitta. But how do you pluck out your eye to give to somebody? Can you stick your fingers in your eye socket to pull it out? You can? Yeah? And how hard is it to pull out? They say we've done everything in samsara. You've never done that.
I've forgotten.
You forgot. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. There's interesting stories, I won't tell you the ones I really love. Or should I? Okay. Story time. So once upon a time, little boys and girls, so there was a man who I think he hadn't yet gotten married. He was looking for a wife, and somebody told him, I don't know if he went to a fortune teller or whatever, that he was going to have however many kids. And he got so excited, he went home and said, I'm going to have 14 kids. And what am I going to name them? And this is so, he got so excited about having kids and trying to figure out what to name of them. So he started dancing, and there was a stick in his room. This is in old Tibet. So, you keep sticks around in case there's some animal or whatever. And he picked up a stick and he started dancing you know, with his stick. I don't know, the tango, the mambo, the waltz. He got so excited, and he's waving the stick around, and he waves it, and he had stored his bags of sampa by tying them to the rafters of the ceiling. Yeah. And so his precious bags of sampa, in old Tibet, you know, sampa was worth a lot. It was not only your food, but it was something you traded with other people to get what you wanted. And he hits one of those bags of sampa, and it crashes to the floor, you know, and all the sampa goes everywhere. Yeah. Huh?
Hit him on the head and killed
it. Oh, maybe it did that too. and then it splattered on the floor and went everywhere. Yeah. And the moral of the story is, don't get so excited about the future, because it could kill you. You know, your mind, I mean, we could spend a whole retreat planning what we're going to do in the future, don't we? Yeah. Yeah, I'm so excited. I'm going to go and study this. Then I'm going to go here and study that. Then I'm going to do retreat. And I want to go meet this teacher. And I want to meet that teacher. And, you know, the other teacher, and do some retreat in there. And then, you know, yeah, we can plan the whole thing out. And of course, you're going to live to, you know, 108. So you can do all of this. Okay, so that's, you know, it's a nice story. Don't get caught up in your future plans. Mm-hmm. The other nice story, this one also relates to precious human life, is the guy who, what was it? He was standing on the edge of a cliff, you know, or he was walking on a cliff, and he fell off, and there was a wild ass or mule running by, and he fell off the cliff, and he landed on the mule instead of crashing to the ground, yeah. And so he was so excited, you know. Oh, I landed on this mule. But he landed backwards, you know, and he didn't fall off the mule. And he got so excited about, how often do you fall off a cliff and land backwards on a mule that runs really fast, and you can feel the wind blowing in your hair, but everything's blowing the wrong way because you're facing the wrong way. Yeah, you remember that story? Yeah. Yeah, the Tibetans have some really good stories, you know. Yeah. So, okay, let's get back to the text here. But the point is attachment to the body. Okay, so these two perspectives, the body is, you know, precious human life, and the body is like made of foul substances. They're cultivated at different stages of the path and serve different purposes. Okay, to arouse enthusiasm for Dharma practice, we rejoice at having a human body. So that's not, the foulness of the body should not be the first meditation you do when you meet the Dharma. Okay? The Lam Rim is arranged in a certain order for a purpose. Yeah? Okay? So we rejoice at having a human body to strengthen our aspiration for liberation and awakening. We have to see the undesirability of the body and to abandon attachment to us, because that attachment keeps us bound in samsara. So to abandon that attachment, we meditate on the foulness of the body, and we meditate what it's going to look like as a corpse. Okay. Thus, we practice the middle way of caring for this body with the Dharma motivation. We don't torture it, but we don't indulge it either. So we don't go to the rush to the doctor whenever we have this tiniest thing. And we don't wait until like we're really sick either. Yeah. So we go somewhere, it's not going away, go to the doctor and, you know, and get your cancer diagnosis that you're so terrified he's going to say, which, you know, he doesn't for most people. But sometimes, at some time in our life, we're going to get a diagnosis that we don't like, unless we die first. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the purpose of meditating with mindfulness on the body is to see the body as it really is, without the fantasies we habitually project on it. You want to see fantasies about the body? Look at the really famous people in our society, the athletes, the movie stars, and what they do with their bodies. And it tells you something about the fantasies that people have about their bodies and what they will do to actualize their fantasies. And it's really sad. Did you know? Taylor Swift, rented the Madison Square Gardens. People are thinking that that's when she and her fiancé are going to get married. Can you imagine what that is going to look like? And how people are going to dress, and how people think about their bodies and care about their bodies if you were one of the thousands of people invited to Madison Square Gardens to her wedding. Yeah. Whew. Can you imagine being the wedding planner? Oh, God. What do you do with that? Okay. We don't torture it, but we don't indulge it either. The purpose of meditating with mindfulness on the body is to see the body as it really is, without the fantasies we habitually project on it. These fantasies lead people to have two main attitudes towards their body. In the first, we indulge in the pleasures the body can provide, giving it everything possible so that it will bring us happiness, comfort, pleasure, praise, everything we can get this body will give us. So we indulge in the pleasures that the body can provide, giving it everything possible so that it will bring us happiness. In the second way, we are adversarial, resenting various aspects of our body and fighting with it. So some people really hate their body. And it's like, it doesn't look the way I want it to look. It's getting old and more wrinkles. And I look at the pictures when I was young, and I don't recognize that person. And now, the body is very uncomfortable. This heating pad with all its bumps. This thing driving me crazy. laughing at? You haven't sat on a hot heating pad with all the bumps underneath it? Just you wait. Someday. Okay. So the first attitude of indulging the body is probably more prevalent. It is what fuels us to seek sensual pleasure in whatever way possible. Attractive clothing, comfortable furniture, swimming pools, sports, drugs, food, drugs, sex, drugs, sex, drugs, rock and roll, sex, drugs. It's true. And in the middle of that, it's, you know, the clothes that you got to wear to hang out with the people that you want to be seen as hanging out with. Okay. When I was young, yeah, one of the things that gave us a lot of status, okay, this was in the hippie movement. You know, because when you got your jeans, you know, now your jeans come torn and everything because that's the style, which is really rather dumb. You know, in the old days, we got our jeans and they were all put together properly, no holes, no tears. But status was when you wore your jeans so long that they started to have tears and holes. And then you got to sew patches on them. Do you remember? Yeah. And the fabric of your patches and how many patches you had and how big your patches were. And when you had to patch your patches, these things gave you status. Especially when you were a traveler, you know, and you just have to use your one set of clothes. And your status was how long you have been traveling. Because, you know, you weren't just traveling in, you know, Kansas and meeting the Tin Man and the Lion and, the, you know, and Dorothy. No, you were traveling, you know, overland to India, or, you know, somewhere over North Africa, you know, where nobody else went. And your jeans ripped and, you know, you sewed them, or you were climbing in the Rockies and then they really got torn. And yeah, that was status. Yeah. But now it's not status. Yeah. What else was status back in the day of the dinosaur was tie-dye. Yeah. Tie-dye, you don't know what tie-dye is? It became popular again just a few years ago. Yeah. Tie-dye. Okay. You remember tie-dye. Yeah. Okay. Do you have some tie-dye stuff at home? No? No? Do you, anybody have?
I'll bring some.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Look through your drawers. Okay. So how you do tie-dye is you take the cloth and you tie rubber bands or rope, you know, string about it. You bunch it into different interesting kinds of bunches, and you tie a string around it. And so your shirt has many different things, you know. And then you have different colored dye, and you dip your things in the different colored dye. And so then you have a shirt. You start out with a white t-shirt, and then pretty soon it's all these really interesting colors and interesting shapes, and you got if you made your own tie-dye yourself, you got status for that too. Okay. So, you know, every generation has the thing that gives us status. What you do to impress your friends. You know? To impress your friends and drive your parents crazy. Okay. So we indulge the body. We look, when we look around, we see that most businesses are involved with providing the body with comfort and pleasure in one way or another, directly or indirectly. Gyms, pharmacies, hairstylists, barbers, vacation resorts, sports equipment, massages, furniture, restaurants, yeah, the beach, the things you float on in water, your surfboard, your skateboard, yeah, everything to give the body fun and pleasure, okay, and status, yeah, because we like to show these things off. Yeah, your car. Mm-hmm. Don't get a Porsche. They're incredibly uncomfortable to sit on. Yeah. Who was I with? You. Yeah. And were you in the Porsche? No. It was Mary Grace. Yeah. And we were sitting in the back of this guy's, because he was driving us to the airport. So uncomfortable. You were sitting in the front. Was it comfortable? Yes. Yeah, the men in the front and Mary Grace in the back. You know how it is. Yeah. You love when I make remarks like that, don't you? Yeah, good. Okay, check the object to be negated. Yeah, but yeah, just how to be comfortable. Yeah. Banks, schools, and other service industries provides societal infrastructure that supports all these activities. Yeah, so your phone, your credit card, yeah, these things become very important because that's how you get the things that give pleasure to your body. Yeah, music. Also, painting, art. The other attitude is an adversarial one, one in which we are in conflict with our body. We hate the body because it doesn't look the way we want it to. We fear our body falling ill, getting injured, aging, and dying. We hate that idea. Get used to it. Yeah. And if we prepare for it, then if we prepare for death, then they say that it's like going on a picnic. And the people who are well prepared for death, it's just like, you know, easy going and goodbye. Mm-hmm. Okay. These dysfunctional ways of relating to the body are based on seeing it as permanent and thus expecting the body to remain in good health and to live without limits. Believing that the body has the capacity to bring us happiness, we indulge in sense pleasures and are angry when old pleasures are no longer enjoyable. Okay. Now we get angry when the things that used to make us feel good no longer do, or we can't do them. Yeah. By clinging to the body as I or mine, our identity and value as a human being becomes tied to our bodies. Or seeing the body as my possession, we are fearful of losing it at the time of death. Yeah, true. Throughout the ages, people have suffered tremendously due to holding distorted conceptions about their bodies. I just think also of Nancy Reagan, who planned her whole funeral out and how, you know, what she was going to wear in the casket, arrange for somebody to come and do her hair, everything. Yeah, so that the body looks good in the casket. Talk about attachment. Okay. By clinging to the body as I or mine, our identity and value as a human being becomes tied to our body. Or seeing the body as my possession, we are fearful of losing it at the time of death. Throughout the ages, people have suffered tremendously due to holding distorted conceptions about their bodies. This anguish is especially noticeable today. Yeah, and our efforts to distract ourselves from it often create more misery. Yeah, because you're trying to make the body look the way you want it to look. And what we go through to try and make the body look the way we want it to look. Yeah. Everybody, you know, so, or we're a health food fad freak, and, you know, the body's got to be healthy. So, you know, you have 25 supplements, yeah, and you take these every day, and you take another 25 the next day. And then the third day, you take 50, you know, both of them, because you got to keep the body healthy. Yeah. However, putting continuous energy into mindfulness of the body in the correct way will result in realistic notions and expectations regarding the body. And these, in turn, will lessen misery in relation to our bodies. If you know what to expect, and in your meditation you rehearse, you visualize, you know, what your body's going to look like as it ages. You visualize, you imagine what it's going to feel like when you can't do what you used to do. Okay, if you can't visualize it, that's why you have senior monastics. You can ask us and we'll tell you. Okay, right? Yeah, we'll tell you what happens to the body, you know, as soon as it happens. Yeah, you'll hear every complaint. Yeah. But we're not complaining. We're just educating you so that you aren't so attached to the body. Right? Right? Mindfulness of the body is as necessary now as it was when the Buddha taught it 26 centuries ago. This practice, when properly and fully done, leads to well-being in the present and to liberation in the long term. Because how does it lead to liberation? Stay tuned, it's coming. But basically, we meditate on its impermanence, yeah, its inability to bring us pleasure, lasting pleasure, yeah, its foulness, and its emptiness of inherent existence. Yeah. Okay, so the reflection. What are the purposes of meditating with mindfulness on the body? Okay, so this is part of your homework. Yeah. Then two, some people feel resistance to doing this meditation because they are concerned it will reinforce negative views of the body, the negative views of the body they learned as children. Or because they are artists or scientists and find the body fascinating. Yeah? I mean, the artists painting the body, sculpting the body, some of the most famous pieces of art are in relationship to how well they sculpted or painted the body. And so they're fascinated with it. I remember, you know, as a kid reading about Michelangelo, and, you know, he used to go to the cemeteries and dissect corpses so that he could learn where the muscles are and how things are attached and the sizes of the bones. And, you know, he wanted to know what it looked like under the skin so that when he sculpted the David, he could do it exactly the way it looks. And so he would, you know, dissect these bodies. Okay. But some people feel resistant, yeah, because they are concerned it will reinforce negative views of the body they learned as children, or because they are artists or scientists and they find the body fascinating to paint, sculpt, or study. Yeah, scientists love, you know, working with the body, the genes of the body, trying to cure the body, make it live forever. Good luck. Yeah, or they're resistant because they enjoy intimate physical relationships, and this meditation will affect that. So here I have another story to tell. When I lived in Singapore, you know, I often went to the polytechnics and the universities, you know, to teach. And the students would come to the Dharma Center sometimes, you know. So there was one young man, he was studying to be an engineer. I think he went to NTU. And he came to see me one day and he said, "I'm so attached to sex, you know, and it's driving me crazy. What do I do?" You know, he's at the age where your hormones are raging. I said, "What do I do?" So I told him about the meditation on meditating on the foulness of the body. You know, this is the one the Buddha prescribed. Okay, so he went away, and then he came back after some time. And he said, "Yeah, I meditated on that, so I don't have the same problem, but now I don't want to have sex at all. And my girlfriend doesn't like that." Yeah, it was interesting, you know. But because he went overboard, yeah. Okay, so this practice, when properly and fully done, leads to well-being in the present and to liberation in the long term. Okay, so do you find hesitation or resistance in yourself to doing this, the meditations on the body, either the impermanence of the body, the foulness? Yeah. So just check. And if so, where is it coming from? You know, is it something you learned at Sunday school? Or did you learn it from your parents? Or, you know, did you learn it as teenagers? Oh my goodness, and as children. Yeah, nowadays, I think kids eat very, very young, get a hold of porn magazines, or they can find out how to watch porn on the internet, and then they look at some of what's going on, and they go, yeah. Or they go, you know. I mean, who knows how kids are going to react. Yeah. But, yeah. So what ideas do you have for how to soften that resistance to meditating on the body? Okay, so that's homework for you. In the Establishments of Mindfulness Sutta, the Buddha detailed several meditation objects for mindfulness of the body. For example, the breath, four postures, sitting, lying down, moving, and standing. The elements that compose the body, the foulness of the body, and the body as a corpse. The instructions on how to do these meditations are described clearly below. Rather than repeat them in a series of reflections, please pause after each section and do the meditation when it's fresh in your mind. And doing each new meditation several times will increase your comfort with it. And also write down, you know, as you're studying this, the different points in the meditation so that you can do it on your own. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to start out with some of the kinds of meditations on mindfulness of the body. So the first one is mindfulness of breathing. According to traditional accounts, on the night of his awakening, the Buddha meditated on mindfulness of the breath. I don't think that was the only thing he meditated on, but he did meditate on that. This mindfulness extends to all four objects of mindfulness. Okay, so the Buddha instructs, and I'm going to read this verse from the Majjhima Nikaya. How does a monastic abide contemplating the body as a body? Here a monastic sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him. What does he establish mindfulness on? One, ever mindful, he breathes in. Mindful, he breathes out. Sounds easy? Can you keep your concentration on the breath? Okay, two, breathing in long, a long breath, he understands, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands, I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, a short breath, he understands, I breathe out short. Okay, three, he trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the whole body of breath. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the whole body of breath. He trains thus, I shall breathe in. This is number four. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, calming the body formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, calming the body for bodily formation. So these are four phases of mindfulness of breathing. In the first, be aware of and observe each in and out breath. Okay. In the second, mindfulness deepens so that while breathing in, while breathing a long breath in and out, observe so that while breathing a long breath in and out, observe and understand that you are breathing this way. Okay. When breathing in and out a short breath, observe and understand that this is a short breath. Okay. So this part gets more interesting, yeah? And especially when, at least for me, when I start seeing, you know, experiencing a long breath and a short breath, and what part of the body is moving in a long breath, what part is moving in a short breath, what is the feeling sensation in my body with a long breath and a short breath, what is the emotion in my body with a long breath or a short breath. And if you, as you begin to look, you know, when your mind is relaxed, your breathing becomes longer and slower. When you're more stressed, your breathing is shorter and quicker. When you're breathing long breaths, your diaphragm, you know, here, goes out, your abdomen goes out. When you're breathing in, when you're breathing out, it falls. When you're tense, you're not breathing from your abdomen, you're breathing from the upper part of your chest, and it's short breaths. And you can really, you know, it's a way to kind of get to know yourself. To observe the breath and like, okay, this is how my breath feels. What's going on in my mind? Yeah. Yeah, because sometimes the breath feels like it's very smooth and it's flowing naturally. And sometimes it feels like it's, you know, rough or jagged somehow. Yeah. So, and then you look, okay, what's going on in my mind when my breath is like this? And this, there's some technique, what's it called? Neuro something. Anyway, it was a big rage some years ago. You know, really emphasizing that we begin to see what is going on in our mind with each kind of breath. And then to pay attention to other people's breathing rhythm. And you can get some idea of what's going on with them when, you know, if you can tune into how they're breathing. And then, you know, if sometimes if you're trying to help somebody, tune into the way they're breathing and you breathe the exact same way. Like if they're breathing very short breaths, you do that with them. But then you slowly make your breath a little bit longer. Yeah. And that can help the person be, you know, because if you don't say, hey, you know, I'm breathing together with you, so watch my breathing pattern and you slow down when I do. No, you just do this naturally because apparently human beings, you know, we respond to how the people around us are breathing. It's like when you're walking, you know, how sometimes just naturally, if it's somebody who's about your same height, you can, you know, you wind up matching your steps. Yeah. So similarly, you know, it's a way of matching the breathing pattern. Yeah. And certainly when somebody's sick, yeah, you really are watching the breath and you can get some idea of what's going on with the person. Okay. So there are four phases of the mindfulness of breathing. In the first, be aware of and observe each in and out breath. Okay. Then the second phase, mindfulness deepens so that by breathing a long breath in and out, you observe and understand that you are breathing this way. I don't think that means you deliberately breathe long in and out, but you just are watching, you know, is this a long breath or a short breath? When breathing in and out short, observe and understand that this is a short breath. Understanding introduces introspective awareness as a support for mindfulness. So your mindfulness is on the breath, but your introspective awareness is noticing what are the qualities of the breath. Okay, is it slow? Is it fast? In addition to being aware of a long or a short breath, comprehend that it is long or short. Long seems to imply a coarse breath, and short a more refined breath. I wonder, you know, you gotta check up if that's how your long breaths are. Maybe if you're really trying to do a deep breath, it's hard, and so your breath becomes choppy and kind of coarse because you, yeah, it's coarse. I mean, it makes more sound when you're trying to do a deep breath, you know, and you could think of it more refined with a short breath. But in terms of what you're feeling, a long breath may bring me emotionally like more relaxed and a short breath more tense. So this is, you know, what to figure out, what to observe. Okay. So don't think I'm breathing in long or I'm breathing in short. Yeah. But observe and understand the breath. You know, I mean, this doesn't mean the thought may enter your mind, oh, this is what a long breath is. But then, okay, now you know it's a long breath. So now you just observe what it feels like or what the short breath feels like. In the third phase, okay, be aware of and observe the entire action of breathing in from when it starts through the middle of each breath to the natural end of the inhalation. Yeah. When breathing out, be aware of and observe the entire breath from the beginning to the end, yeah, of the exhalation. Okay. So you observe it with mindfulness, your introspective awareness is, you know, your mindfulness is on the breath, your introspective awareness is observing that. Okay. So that it gets more interesting because you start asking at one point, what in the world is the breath? Yeah. When you start this whole meditation, oh, breathing in, breathing out, you never ask what is the breath. You think you know what the breath is. But as you start watching it more closely, when does the breath start? And is the breath the air? Is the breath the air? Is it the air? Is it the diaphragm or the lungs? Yeah, we say, I'm breathing. What is this breath? Okay. And it's asking me, when does a breath start and when does it stop? When does an inhalation start? Can you pinpoint it? Yeah, when you're breathing naturally, so you're not saying, okay, I'm holding my breath and now I'm going to inhale, you know. No, you're just breathing naturally. Can you tell when your breath, an inhalation starts? Can you tell when it's completed? Can you tell when an exhalation starts, when it's completed? This helps deepen the concentration. So you really have to be more concentrated for this. But where? I can get a feeling for when it starts and where it stops. But what is this breath? What does it mean to breathe? Yeah. Is breathing something my lungs are doing? My diaphragm? Yeah. My nose? When I say I can't breathe because I have a cold or I have an allergy? Yeah. What does I can't breathe mean? What is the breath that you can't do? It gets really interesting. Yeah? So breath the air. But the air is just air. And it's outside of me and then it goes inside. But where does it go when it goes inside? And how does the oxygen get to all the cells? And what happens to it when it comes inside? Okay, there's all these little, what are they called, areoles or something in your lungs. And the oxygen is absorbing into these little, you know, things. And then the blood vessels go by that and the oxygen gets into the blood. You mean I have bubbles in my blood? Does the oxygen in my blood make bubbles? It better not. How does the oxygen get in the blood? Is the oxygen my breath? But when I exhale, it's the carbon dioxide that goes out. Where did that come in? Where's that carbon dioxide coming in? Yeah. And how come it's good if I live in a place with a lot of plants? Yeah. Do you know why? Yeah. The plants take up the carbon dioxide and put out the oxygen. Are the plants breathing? Do they breathe? Can they hold their breath? Yeah. But some people talk to their plants. Yeah. Can the plants be alive? Doesn't alive mean you're breathing? Are plants alive? Yeah. How about, what are they called? Amoeba. Are they alive? When there's an amoeba in my body, is it alive? When it's not in my body and it's in the water or the food, is it alive? What does an amoeba eat? And I feel my amoebas. Oh, there goes one. Yeah. What is the breath? Okay. While breathing out, be aware of and observe the entire out-breath from beginning to end with mindfulness. According to the Pali commentarial interpretation, when it says the whole body, that refers to the entire in or out-breath. And did we come to the part already the way Vasubandhu has? Did we do that? In what section was that?
Early in the training.
Was it? I can't remember where I put it in the book. It's a very interesting thing because he says that you inhale and you imagine the breath as like a string that's going down into your body, and the breath is like a string and it goes up. And then when you exhale, it's coming this way. Yeah? So, did
you? Well, I was trying to remember if that was in the Vajrayana section.
Yeah, we might bump into it in this section, so hold on. But he gave it this, how he recommends the breathing meditation and several different steps. Okay. But here, the Pali commentary, the whole body refers to the entire in or out breath. So is the breath just an inhalation or is it also an outhalation? And what comes first? We always think first you inhale, then you exhale. Yeah. In certain tantra practices, what is emphasized is the exhalation and then the inhalation. Why do they do that? Okay. So here, mindfulness doesn't simply notice the inhalation and exhalation. It experiences it. The mind must be in the present moment to fully experience and understand each portion of the breath. This practice develops the continuity of mindfulness so that the mind does not wander as you breathe. And then when you're off the cushion, you watch the breath too. Hmm. Some contemporary teachers say that the whole breath, that phrase, means that mindfulness is extended to experience the entire physical body while mindfully inhaling and exhaling. I think Vasubandhu's goes more in that direction. Okay, and the fourth phase, in the fourth phase, while you breathe, calm the breath, making it tranquil, soft, and gentle. Can you make your breath tranquil, soft, and gentle? What happens to the state of your mind when you deliberately try and make your mind, soft and gentle and peaceful? Does your mind become soft, gentle, and peaceful? Or does your mind become more uptight because I'm trying to make it peaceful and it's not peaceful enough? And then all this anxiety comes. Am I doing it right? Am I breathing right? Oh, goodness, it's supposed to be coming soft, gentle, and peaceful, and it's not. My breathing is loud, and it's rough, and it ends with me coughing, or sneezing, and I can't even breathe right. I knew I was a failure. That's when you really get in touch with how self-critical you are. When you can't even breathe right because there's a right way to breathe. My goodness, what we do to ourselves. Yeah. How we make ourselves miserable saying there's a right way to breathe. Just breathe. Don't stop. Just keep on. Okay, so in the fourth phase, while you breathe, calm the breath, making it tranquil, soft, and gentle. The bodily formation refers to breathing in and out. Because the breath is connected to so many other physical and mental processes, breathing mindfully in this way calms the entire body and mind, making them peaceful. If you have trouble falling asleep at night, be aware of the sensations in your body. You will probably find that you have some muscle or another clenched or tight. And it may be a muscle that you never even think about. And then there it is. It's tight. Do you know how often do you think about your hamstrings or your calf muscles? Yeah. But then you lie down to sleep and you can't. And it's like, oh, there's tension in my legs. Or there's tension in my gut. I'm squeezing my gut somehow. Or there's tension in my upper back. Or my facial muscles. I'm lying in bed and my facial muscles are tense. You know, it's really interesting what you find out when you start doing this. Yeah. And then you learn to deliberately relax those muscles. Yeah. Yeah. You learn, you know, it's a process to learn. Because some of this, we're so used to keeping that muscle tense that, you know, to relax it, what does that mean? How do you do that? But you slowly learn. And then, you know, you're able to fall asleep easier. And, you know, especially too, if when you lie down to sleep, your mind is racing. Yeah. Oh, somebody said that the carrots were burnt today. Oh, I can never make the carrots right. Right. I put everything I could do, my heart, into the lunch. And because you're doing your review of the day. And so it goes to, and I burnt the carrots, and I was trying so hard not to burn the carrots. And, you know, and like, oh, my mind is tense. I'm falling into being self-critical. Yeah. And look at, yeah, because you're saying, look at me, I can't even cook the carrots right. Wow. No wonder I can't fall asleep. I'm criticizing myself about cooking carrots. And then you have to laugh. Yeah, because it is funny, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so then, yeah, you just become aware of that. Okay. Yeah, sweet. Well, you breathe, calm the breath. Okay. So, while breathing mindful of the breath, while being mindful of the breath, don't forcefully control the breath. Yeah, that's when you get people in your retreat who are... Yeah, there was a retreat we did a few years ago, and I won't mention who came, but people were coming to me, yeah, because you were in different rooms according to what you were meditating on, and this one man was in one room, and people were coming. This guy breathes so loud, you know, so... You know, I asked him, well, how are you breathing? And he said, I'm trying to deep breathe and get more oxygen into my system. Yeah. Or I'm doing, you know, the one where you're breathing in one nostril, out the other. I'm doing that, and I'm supposed to get the breath all the way down to my navel and then exhale, so I have to breathe a long time. Yeah. One time, Geshe Jampa Tekchok, he was teaching us the medicine, you know, the meditation of the breath, the 9-point breathing meditation. And we said, Geshe-la, will you just do it for us so we can get how we do it? His in-breaths and out-breaths were like as long as I don't know how many of my breaths. He could inhale a really long time and out exhale a long time. I mean, he was a big guy, but, you know, he'd also been doing that, you know, that meditation. We all were like, whoa, you know. Okay. Accept the breathing pattern. Accept the breathing pattern that is present at any particular moment. This is important. Don't, you know, force your breath. Yeah, pay attention to it, knowing that the texture, tempo, and other aspects of the breath will naturally change as mindfulness deepens. As the mind becomes more concentrated, the breath will naturally become calmer and slower. Okay, so we're going to stop here.
Venerable Bandhu, I think it's on page 182.
On?
182.
We did it already?
Yeah, we did.
And we forgot?
Well, there were so many there. It's 6 points.
Yeah, I remember he had a lot of points. Okay. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Starts on 182. So you can also look at that one. And, you know, he taught it in to counteract discursive thought, but it's also brings you much more investigation and awareness, yeah. And maybe you might figure out what it means to breathe and where the breath is going. Yeah. Okay. Questions, comments? Yeah.
In my experience so far with this aging thing, I haven't been able to really deeply imagine has been happening. So the details are so specific in certain situations that my mind hasn't just not gone there. So I think in my case, it's really experiential with these changes that are happening.
Yeah.
Because my mind before, I'd look at what my parents were going through. I'd thank them for showing me the example of what it looks like to get older.
Mm-hmm.
And it was with the arrogance of youth, I'll be honest. And we all have it. Because you can find somebody older than you at some point. And then there's the arrogance of youth. It just does not go away.
Mm-hmm.
And so that obscures what I can imagine. But then I just don't know. I could have never imagined what would happen after fracturing a wrist.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I couldn't have imagined, you know, the day-to-day.
Yeah.
So that's in my case.
Yeah.
And maybe these experiences, as we get older and older, if we get that privilege of getting older and older, then that fuels our imagination. Do you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that sometimes if you listen to older people, or if you listen to sick people, and then you sit there, what would that feel like to have a pain in a certain place? Yeah, what would it feel like to want to move my knee and it's not moving, or it's moving and it hurts? Because sometimes we've had pain in different parts of our body before, so you just take what we've had and then imagining it being worse and longer. Yeah, just so you know, because we have to build up some kind of fortitude. Yeah. Otherwise, as we age, we're gonna become just the biggest cranks you can imagine. Yeah. This is hurting. That's hurting. Oh goodness. Yeah. So, yeah.
I just want to come have I have a comment that for me the illness has been the most incredible teaching of humility. Because I was thinking I'm young and I'm in the perfect shape and everything, and then I can feel how is the same process of aging and having pain and all the other things, and it's really humble, and I have tried to learn to be compassionate with myself, but at the same time as you were saying, I now understand when somebody is saying, I feel this. Oh, I now have
this. You know what they feel.
So
yeah.
It's really a huge teaching in,
yeah,
in how to be feel empathy and at the same mm-hmm. compassion.
Yeah.
A question related to the breathing or mindfulness of breathing. You know, right now, many of us have been struggling with a cold or allergies. And so for me, if I turn my attention to my breath, I mostly become aware of how congested I am, and it starts to feel like I'm suffocating. So I find that if I'm not paying attention to it, well, okay, I'm not going to die, obviously. Uh-huh. But is the answer then to just not meditate on the breath while I'm congested?
That might be a good idea. I used to have really bad allergies, and I would laugh at myself when I taught the breathing meditation because I couldn't breathe. Both my nostrils were blocked. So that isn't the meditation to do when you have a cold. Okay. You had something?
Two things. I completely understand, or I can appreciate what Venerable Somthin is saying. And the last few years, I find myself thinking, oh, I wish I had understood this about my mother when she was going through it, because I couldn't imagine. I didn't have the ability to imagine what it was like to be 25 years older.
Yeah.
The other thing that came to my mind when you were describing those questions, like what is the breath, what is the air, what is the diaphragm, it becomes very interesting. So it almost becomes like the scientist who is so fascinated with the body. I found that the first time we did the retreat on the four establishments, that I was so fascinated that blood was moving through every part of my body. You know, I mean, it becomes so magnifying when you go do a deep meditation like that. But it was almost distracting.
Yeah.
So I hope we get a chance to do this meditation again for retreat and
retreat. Yeah, sure, we can.
This winter.
Yeah, we can. That we can make it the winter retreat. Yeah, and you can, you know, start doing it now as part of your daily practice too, or just when you're lying in bed. Yeah, when you just lie down, just check in and what's going on in my body. Okay, so with this. We did, how many pages did we do today? 1, 2, 3, 4. We did something. The number isn't important. Yeah, the quality, not quantity. So when we're doing the mandala offering, you know, do the inner mandala where you imagine the different parts of your body transforming into the universe as it's imagined in ancient Indian thing, you know. And it's very interesting because you dissect your body and your stomach is Mount Meru. And you just disassemble it. It becomes, you know, if you remember how to think when you're doing that, you know, and then you have the rings of around Mount Meru that are your intestines, and the blood and the lymph are the water, you know, the water in the ocean between the different rings of mountains, and your what is it? Your hand and your feet are the four continents. Upper and lower arm, upper and lower leg are the eight subcontinents. And you visualize this. It's a wonderful meditation for overcoming attachment to the body, because you're just transforming it, and then it becomes something beautiful, and you offer it to the Buddha.